podcasting from Nashville Guitar Store in the heart of Music City, USA. Bringing you inspiration, education, and behind-the-scenes stories from prominent guitarists and others influential in the music profession. Sharing tales of their history, discussing guitars, their gear, their work, what's on tap for the future, and delivering wisdom we'll all appreciate. Your host is Marcia Ware Wilder, nationally recognized radio personality, singer, actor, and author.
Our guest today is the great Dave Pomeroy, bassist extraordinaire. He has contributed to albums for folks like Trisha Yearwood, Emmylou Harris, Neil Diamond, Billy Ray Cyrus, Randy Scruggs, Duane Eddy, Alison Moore, Steve Warner. He's also worked with Asleep at the Wheel, Matreka Berg, Kathy Mattea, Alison Krauss, and the late Keith Whitley. Just that's the tip of the iceberg. I want to know about your time with Keith down the road. He has held down the bottom end for folks like Don Williams and the man who gets my vote for the coolest stage name, Sleepy LaBeef. What the what?
Yeah, he is. What an interesting guy. My first Nashville job.
Oh, my goodness.
Was with Sleepy.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in just a second. Because, in fact, welcome to the show, by the way.
I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. And appreciate you taking the time. So, we start here at NashvilleGuitarStore.com. We always go back to the very, 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 very beginning. And you got your start, even though you are American. You were born in Italy, correct?
Yeah, my dad was military, so we did a lot of globetrotting when we were little, and then eventually settled in Northern Virginia area when I was about eight. But first few years of my life were pretty interesting. We lived in Italy, and I wish I could say I remember it.
Right.
We left when I was pretty small, and ended up in England, first Germany and then Colorado, which is the first place I really remember,
right.
Colorado Springs at the Air Force Academy. And then we moved to England when I was 5 years old in 1961. And lived there for 3 years. And, of course, that was an incredible time when the Beatles came out of nowhere in mid-1962. And as just a little kid watching the television, I thought, boy, those guys are having fun.
Yeah.
And I never really thought that it could be a job to have that much fun.
I still don't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You mean I get paid, too?
Exactly.
So, interesting how that all comes around. So that was kind of the big bang for me, was just seeing music in the television, you know, early television era. And then we moved to D.C. and mm-hmm. I started playing the bass when I was 10.
Excellent. Oh, I don't know. Structured?
Very much so.
Yeah.
And really, and thankfully, there was a stop in between those two extremes of bass solos on anything and Don Williams, where a bass solo is definitely out of the question, I was doing a little rehearsal with some guys at somebody's house in preparation for a gig, and the drummer kind of pulled me aside and said, hey, you know, you're a good bass player. Would you be interested in playing with Guy Clark? And I said, well, yeah, and not really knowing exactly right. who Guy Clark was. It was a name that I'd heard, but I wasn't, you know, up on everything. And so I found myself 2 days later sitting in that same basement on Woodmont Boulevard, just me and Guy Clark, and he's teaching me his catalog. And these songs were so amazing, and the lyrics were so amazing, and musically, it was the simplest stuff I'd ever heard. Mm-hmm. And my first thought was, why does this even need a bass? But I got to do something, so
yeah.
I'll just play real simple. And it was sort of like putting the brakes on, going 180 miles an hour, and
yeah.
I got back down to about 90. And then Don Williams, 6 or 8 months later, I got the opportunity to work with Don, because I knew the guys in his band. And so I think if I hadn't had Guy Clark as a intermediary
yeah,
of just learning how to play
yeah.
less
yeah.
and fewer notes. And so when I got the gig with Don, it was definitely the big break of my career in terms of, you know, going from playing little clubs and just wherever to playing stadiums and TV shows. And Don was at the peak of his career, mm-hmm. and he really was a great guy to work for. He, again, took on almost a father figure kind of role and gave me some of the best musical advice I ever got. I'd been with him a couple of years, and I was still learning how to calm down a little bit.
Yeah.
And still but wanting to be creative. And Don said to me one night, he said, David, just because you don't mm-hmm. How did he put it? He said, you don't have to play exactly what's on the record. just don't throw me off.
Yeah, right.
And it was basically saying, you can be creative, but don't get in my way when I'm telling a story.
Right.
And it was the nicest, gentlest way. And I've taken that approach to almost everything I've done the rest of my musical life. Is like, yes, you can be creative, but listen to what everybody else is doing. And so, you know, it was such a great experience. And through Don, I gradually got into doing studio work. And it was a really long transition. And it was really because of his encouragement that I was, you know, not scared to try that. Because at the time, there was a very hard line between road musicians and studio musicians. And hardly any artists used the same people in both situations other than like Willie Nelson was like, and not even Waylon to some degree, but for the mainstream Nashville country artists, there was a studio band and a road band. And so to be able to kind of gradually work my way through that was really special. And Don encouraged me to write songs. I hadn't really thought that much about writing, and he encouraged me to do that. We even wrote a couple of songs together, that was a great experience. Don was really special.
Awesome. So tell me about the day that the bass players took over the world.
Well, it's all Guy Clark's fault.
Okay.
Again, Guy comes back around, and I had been staying in touch with Guy, and I would occasionally work on demos for him and stuff, and he, you know, was just always a great friend, and he called me one day and said, hey, come on over to the office. I got a song I want to play for you. And I'm thinking, Guy Clark wants to play me a song. Why would he do that? And so I go over there, and of course, he is very deadpan, and he puts on this cassette, and he plays me a song, and it's a woman named Emily Cates from Arkansas. And she's playing the bass and singing a song called The Day the Bass Players Took Over the World. And I couldn't believe it. I'm like, wow, that's just great. And that's my life story.
Yeah.
Or I wish it was. And so I took the song and I made a copy and I kind of worked it up and I kind of did my own version of it. And I added some things and I put in some additional lyrics and I tweaked the lyrics a little bit because there was one or two things I wasn't comfortable singing. And I recorded a version with maybe a dozen bass parts on it or so, doing the roles of the whole band. And then I sent it to Emily sort of like with my fingers crossed and expecting her to go, how dare you change my song?
Right.
And she called back and said, wow, I really like what you did. You know what? For your version of the song, I'm going to make you a co-writer and co-publisher, which she did not have to do. Most people in Nashville would never do that. They might say give you an arrangement credit or something. And that was really cool of her to do that. And so I was emboldened and I went back in the studio again and recorded a version with about 24 bass parts on it. And I sent that version to a guy who was writing for Bass Player magazine. And that led to a feature article in Bass Player. And it led to creating the All Bass Orchestra as a live event where we got multiple bass players together, you know, no drums, no guitars, no nothing.
That is
and
amazing.
It was fun. And so in the 90s, we did a series of these shows called Basses Loaded. And the most people we ever have was 22. That was too many, even for me. the mistake was 22 amplifiers.
Right.
So we changed the way we did it. And we found that the ideal group is around 13 to 16.
Work.
And we arrange them like geographically according to what they play. We have the low basses on one side with guys with five strings and low Bs. And then what we call the mid-range basses, guys playing Fenders and maybe a fretless guy.
Yeah.
Then we'd have four acoustics, two guys doing like rhythmic rockabilly slap kind of stuff, percussion, and even just playing the bass as a drum.
Yeah.
And then two players doing more linear stuff and like jazz stuff and classical, you know, bowed lines. And then we'd have two guys playing six string Dan Electros kind of covering the guitar parts. And then we'd have two more guys with the seven, nine strings playing all this silly high stuff. So it was kind of loosely organized. We had a few tunes where everything was written out, but for the most part, it was me just teaching guys all the different parts because I made these records where I play everything myself.
Right.
And so it was a lot of fun. We did it again. We did about 10 years worth, and then we did took a break for a pretty long while. Did it again in 2014, and it was really fun. We had Paul Simon's bass player, Bakithi Kamalo, who's just a beautiful, sweet guy and a wonderful player. Yeah. We had him as one of the guests, and we did Paul Simon's You Can Call Me Al with like 15 bass players, and it was really fun.
Can you find that? Is that online?
Can you see? Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Okay, I will find
it's
that.
It's on YouTube, and it's fun.
I saw Bob Babbitt's name in the credits of that, too.
We did one with Bob in 2006, I think it was.
Yeah.
And Bob was a good friend and a great guy,
and
I loved him. Yeah. I miss him.
Yeah, me too. That was some of the best years. It's a great, great road experience being with the Funk Brothers of Motown.
I can't imagine.
You know, and to just know that, like, even now, when you turn on the radio and you hear Ball of Confusion, I'm like, that's my boy.
Yep.
That's my boy.
Yeah. Well, that was, absolutely. And I was very honored that his family asked me to give the speech for his induction into the Nashville Walk of Fame, where they have the stars downtown.
Yeah.
And that was heavy.
Well, and that was only fitting.
He was very sick.
Yes.
I went to see him in the hospital before I went to go do it, and he was hallucinating, and honestly, I thought he was going to check out right in front of me.
You and me both.
Because he started talking about the light, and he's going, I can see the light, and I'm thinking,
oh man.
And I'm like, Lord, if this is meant to be, and I'm supposed to be here when he passes, I guess I'm ready.
You know, I just I'm going to make a point to look at where I am in the... Let's see, 27. Yeah, all right, just for my head.
I'm bad with long
inches. No. That's not the point. I was going to tell you a story very quickly. When I went to see him, before he went to hospice, I went to go see him in the hospital St. Thomas, I think it was, or wherever, where the one that has nothing shall be impossible, the one that uses the Bible. Yeah. So anyway, I went to see him there first. And it was so funny because he was laying there, and I kind of leaned over and I kind of started singing in his ear, and he kind of smiled. He's like, hey, and like that. And he started saying black to black, yellow to black, yellow to green, red to red, black to black. And he kept saying that over and over again. And they were like, do you know what he's talking about? I don't know what he's talking about. And I sat there for a second. I said, Bob, are you patching your bass? He goes, yeah, black to black. I gotta patch those chords.
Yeah,
I don't even know if he knew what he was talking about. If that was like a hallucination,
That was incredible. And I had a similar experience, you know. And he kept saying one guy's name, and his wife said that's the saxophone player that he played with when he was in high school.
Oh, bless his heart.
And so I went and I did the event, and the family was there. And then afterwards, I went to see him one more time. And for whatever reason, that time he was much more. Mm-hmm. In the moment, and I even made a little joke about, well, you know, I said they probably write about what happened, you know, about they're going to write about this in the newspaper, but of course nobody reads newspapers anymore.
Right, right,
and he kind of chuckled and laughed, and he did that great laugh of his, and that really that was a special thing for me. I love Bob, you know, he was one of those guys that he one of the only people to ever have a recording career in that many cities.
Mm-hmm.
New York, Los Angeles, Detroit,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. Nashville, and Los Angeles, and all five. And no one that I know has ever done that.
Yeah.
I think it spoke a lot to what a great musician he was, and also what a great person.
Truly one of the greats.
I felt like he was kind of underappreciated in Nashville.
You and me both. And I just always... I knew what kind of greatness I was walking with, but I always joked with him. I said, if he acted like he was getting too big for his britches, I said, don't remember you, just my ride to the airport. Because that's what I would drive across town, and he and Ann would take us to the airport, us off. That was it. But he was just, you're right, he was underappreciated. But like I at his memorial at the Musicians Hall of Fame,
that's right.
I just kept thinking about how often people kept talking about, wow, it was so hard to talk to him. He was just so quiet. And I thought, are they talking about the same Bob?
I'm like,
But because
I think you had to pass the entrance test.
I think
once he
did.
Liked you and trusted you, it was a whole different situation.
It was a whole different situation because I had set up a lunch with Chris Kent and Steve Forrest and a couple other bass players, and we met at this sushi place that's long since gone. It's a Kroger, the Kroger on 96 now down in Franklin on Murfreesboro. Anyway, but... I set it up. They sat down. He just started telling stories. We were there for almost 2 hours, and it was like Jesus giving the Sermon on the Mount. Yeah. I mean, it was that intense.
Masterclass,
they just, it really was. And they just, and I mean no disrespect to my Savior because I love the Lord, but it was just comical to watch these guys, these men that I'd worked with that I respected, listening to their mentor, their sensei, and they're just
I love that.
I mean, that was a beautiful thing to see. I was so glad to be a part of it.
That's so important, you know, and I think, and I can look back at my career and see that it was those people that I respected who taught me things when I was kind of oblivious and it maybe didn't sink in right away, but then you look back and you go, wow, how lucky was I to have been able to be around that person. And Bob was definitely one of those.
Yes, he is. Well, let's get into the technical gear aspect of things for our gearheads out there. For someone who's still learning the ins and the outs of bass guitar, what's the difference between, and this is something, because this is more for me. I just need a question from me.
That's fine. Sure.
What's the difference between active and passive bass guitar?
Well, basically, it's whether or not it has a battery-powered preamp.
Okay.
I mean, there are occasionally basses that you actually would have to plug in an AC, but it's basically, you know, the old style, the original basses were all passive, where it was just a pickup and a knob, and you had to plug it into something and turn it up. Mm-hmm. Whereas as technology began to evolve more, and rather than a preamp being the size of a shoebox, it could be, you know, the size of a postcard or even smaller. And so eventually, some companies began to embrace that technology. I had a very early Gibson bass that was one of the early active ones called the RD Artist. And it was so new that they had neglected to have a backup plan if the battery went out. So in other words, if the battery went out, the bass just stopped working.
Wow.
Whereas almost any active bass made after that time in the late 70s has a bypass switch.
Right.
So that you have a fail safe. Would always, if I was even the least bit concerned, I'd have to open it up and check the battery and make sure, because I didn't want it cutting out in the middle of a gig.
Yeah.
It was a good sounding bass. But again, I ran into that Nashville thing of people looking and going, where's the Fender? It's like, close your eyes and listen to it. Don't listen with your eyes. Listen with your ears, because it was a really good sounding bass. But eventually I embraced the Fender style thing and kind of played that game too. But, you know, I see the value in both. I mean, you know, obviously what you're doing on the back end with a passive bass, if you're switching back and forth, you've got to give the passive bass quite a bit more gain on your amplifier. They both have their pluses and minuses, because, you know, an active bass is going to have more variety, but you can also, if you don't know what you're doing, you can also gum up the tone really badly well. And sometimes there's noise and other things that you wouldn't have that problem with just a regular passive bass that you just plug in. But as those technologies have gotten better, I think, you know, now, but even the basses that I bought more recently, almost all of them have active, passive, and I'll use it both, depending. For me, when I switched to G&L basses, it embraced the Fender thing enough to get those people that were listening with their eyes off my back, and they were Leo Fender's, you know, latest design, the last company he was involved in. And so they're like, look, Leo Fender made this bass, will you please shut up and listen? You know, but they were great because they had active, passive, and they also had a series parallel switch, which is kind of a not something you see very often, where instead of each pickup being its own entity, it's literally feeding one pickup into another, series as opposed to parallel. And what I call was the boom switch, you know, where it was just, it gave you just that little extra edge. If I was going to play a solo, I just reach down and flip that switch and get that little bit of extra gain. And in the studio, it had a certain kind of growl that it didn't have in the other more clean setting. So I like being able to do stuff on the bass. But in the end, it really, a whole lot of it is in your hands and the kind of strings you're using and how high the strings are and whether or not you're really digging in or if you're playing real light. Everybody has different styles. I think maybe because I started playing string bass, I typically like the strings up a little higher than most guys do, and higher than you would find them in a bass in a music store that they want to somebody pick up and go, ooh, it plays so easy, I want to buy it. Because the real tone is in the tension of the string. And so when you have a little more tension, you can get a little bigger sound. And that ended up becoming, you know, kind of my signature thing, I think, was having trying to have a tone that sounded real good before you did anything to it.
Right. Now, with regard to pedal boards, are you a less is more kind of guy in terms of your stage
you know,
setup?
That's a good question. I kind of, you know, I came up through the studio thing starting where you just plugged into a DI and the engineer did everything else. You just
right.
plugged into a box. And then as rack stuff started happening, I did go out and spend some money and buy some nice preamps and compressors and a pretty heavy big studio rack that I would take for sessions. But in terms of live, I have a bunch of pedals, but I was not really so much of a pedal board guy because early on when I started, I've made a real strict separation between what I do when I play for someone else mm-hmm. and what I do when I do my own stuff.
Right.
I typically use very few effects mm-hmm. when I'm working with someone else, but unless they ask for it, mm-hmm. Because once you put an effect on the bass, you're locked. That's there, and you can't
right.
get rid of it.
Right.
So I kind of came up in the school where, please don't send me a chorus or a reverb or a gate or anything. I just want to hear the bass.
Yeah.
So I kind of... Have done that, but early on in my time in Nashville, I met a guitar player named Larry Chaney,
mm-hmm.
great guitar player and a master of sound.
Okay.
And he, in the early days, had a pedal board that he would actually, we used to call it the table. It was like a TV tray, and he'd have all the pedals up there because he would want to turn the knobs while he was playing
wow.
rather than just hitting a preset. But in the early days of multi-effects, mm-hmm. Larry was fantastic at those. We had a band called Tone Patrol, and it would be like, hey, what's that sound like the sun exploding? Oh, that's a guitar. You know, what's that sound like, you know, pigeons, you know, feasting
yeah.
on a turkey? You know, well, that's a guitar, you know. And it was just, he had this amazing ability to get inside these boxes and make them do stuff they weren't designed to do.
Yeah.
And he taught me how to do that. So I pretty early on went to multi-effects.
Uh-huh.
So it, rather than a pedal board, it's like one box that has hundreds of sounds in it that you can go in and tweak and do presets. And then I also got into looping.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, it was just a little stomp box, and
right.
eventually they're bigger now. So when I go out and play solo, I just have these two, you know, rectangular shaped boxes that I use sounds and loops, and I kind of build everything within that. But I've also seen guys that are amazing with pedal boards, and you know, Bootsy and
yeah.
everybody else. To me, the issue with pedal boards was trying to get back to a sound. Like, man, what's that sound I had when the thing
yeah.
was doing this,
and
it
yeah,
was going
yeah.
into that, and I reversed it. And this way, it's like as soon as you get a sound you like, you hit save and you move on to another preset. And
mm-hmm.
so I've got in that box, I've got like 100 sounds, and I've got a whole map and a grid of what they are. And,
yeah.
And so, you know, I think individual pedals for particular things, to me, pedals are kind of like a rock and roll thing and
yeah.
don't necessarily apply to a lot of the music that I've done, which has been not necessarily country, but just singer-songwriter,
mm-hmm.
rootsy stuff
yeah.
where an effect on the bass is kind of like a, you know, the uninvited guest to the party.
Right. Okay.
And that is where we will hit the pause button. Meet me back here in a minute when we continue with our conversation with our guest, Dave Pomeroy. We'll talk about his many, many, many guitars, his advocacy for musicians everywhere, and we'll lighten things up with another round of Take Your Pick. It's all mere seconds away. I'm Marcia Wilder, and you are at NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
At NashvilleGuitarStore.com, paying full price for guitars is a thing of the past. Like dial-up internet. You'll find Epiphone, Fender, Gretsch, Ibanez, Taylor, and lots more. What you won't find is the big box store prices. Get yourself a killer guitar at a fraction of the retail price at NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
NashvilleGuitarStore.com. Every day, but we never meet. My imagination said, ooh, it could be so sweet. But I don't want your casual love. No, that's too cold. Girl, I want to open your heart. Reach out, yeah. Take a hold, cause I wanna mean something to you. Oh, baby, I wanna mean something to you.
song's called Mean Something to You. The voice and the bass belong to our guest this time around, Mr. Dave Pomeroy. Welcome back to the second half of our conversation with him. I'm Marcia Wilder, and you are at NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
So what is your go-to bass?
Well, I have several. I have about 60-some basses, so I have a lot of them, but I definitely have one bass that stands out as far as my musical identity, which is an electric upright bass that I've had since 1982. A guy named Harry Fleischmann built it for me. It was inspired by a German bass player that I had seen when I was living in London and was a huge fan of, named Eberhard Weber.
Okay.
Weber with a W in the German pronunciation.
Yeah, well.
And he recorded for ECM Records, and I saw him fronting his own instrumental band, playing this electric, like a neck with a small body, sitting on a stool, and it just had the most amazing sound. It was at the time when Jaco Pastorius was like turning the bass world upside down, and everybody was trying to sound like Jaco.
Yeah.
And Eberhard had this different kind of fretless sound where it was deeper and it had more of a trombone almost quality to it. Huh. I just fell in love with his tone, and so I made a mental note: someday if I ever have any money, I'd love to have a bass like that.
Yeah.
And so I was in 1981, I was leafing through Guitar Player magazine looking for the occasional bone that they would throw bass players, because it was before Player magazine.
Yes.
And I opened up the New Gear page, and there was a picture of this bass, and I went, holy crap, that looks like it could sound like Eberhard Weber's bass. And it was a stand-up bass with a little bigger body on a stand, but with a solid body. And so I called a guy up. His name is Harry Fleischmann. And my first question was, have you ever heard of Eberhard Weber? And he says, I think so. And I said, can you get that sound? And he said, I don't know. Let me play a little for you over the phone. And he played a few notes.
Wow.
I thought, that's pretty interesting. So as luck would have it, a few months later, he was in Denver at the time. A few months later, we were out on tour, and he brought one of the basses to my hotel room. And I played about four notes, and I went, oh, my gosh. This is what I've been hearing in my head.
So if the building were on fire and you could only save one guitar, would that be the one?
That
would be the one.
And the building was on fire, and thankfully it survived. I did lose some basses in a fire. I actually had a house
did
fire.
Did you really?
Yeah, I lost about 10 basses, but nearest and dearest all survived just by random where they were when the fire happened.
Wow.
And only in Nashville, one of the firemen knew it was my house, so they didn't go crazy with the water. And they But that's another.
No. I love this because
I knew I should have run.
I'm so easily diverted because that's how my brain works. I was never diagnosed as ADD, but I should have been. But anyway, shiny. Anyway, so when the flood came in 2010, you didn't lose any equipment
no,
then?
No, I did
okay, because I know a lot of folks.
Yeah,
I know Steve lost,
there,
Brad lost,
oh
Vince
my gosh,
lost.
Yeah.
I know, because like if you were anywhere like near soundcheck.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was fortunate there in that I really didn't get hurt in that one. But to go back to the electric upright, so, he was building them one at a time. So about 6 months later, it arrived. And I played it, and I kind of thought, oh, my God, what have I done? This is crazy. I can't play this. I don't know what I'm doing. And I got really scared, and I put it away for about a week. And then I got out. It's like, man. I just spent more money than I've ever spent. I got to learn how to play this thing. And so luckily, because Don was open-minded, he allowed me, once I kind of got the basic handle on it, he allowed me to bring it. I brought it out on the road, and I would play it with him on certain songs where it was the appropriate sound, and I was able to kind of gradually get my chops together, and really, because when you're playing any kind of fretless bass, it's got to be in tune, or you just should put it in the case.
Yeah.
And then when I started getting into studio work, that ended up becoming a sound that people identified with me, and it was really Keith Whitley was the turning point there, because I'd started playing on Don Williams records, and I mostly played fretted bass on Don's records because that was kind of the sound and what he did. But then when Garth Fundis started producing Keith Whitley and called me to be involved, I heard his voice, and something in me said, man, this is for the what we call it, the beast, the electric upright. I said, this is that voice. I think the beast would work really good. And so on Keith's first album that we did, Don't Close Your Eyes, I played either the beast or a fretless bass on all but one song. And at the time, nobody was using string bass on country records anymore.
Right.
And hardly anybody was playing fretless bass. And so, Keith was kind of a throwback to a different time. And in my own way, I think I was trying to bring the string bass back into country music. And there was a synergy between the sound of that bass and his voice that was special. And you know, I was perfectly prepared for somebody to go, you know, that's not working. Let's try something else. But everybody liked it. It was cool. And then the records came out, and it made Keith a star. And when the second single, I'm No Stranger to the Rain, came out, and there's a moment in that song where there's a line about, and tonight it's really coming down, and I do this slide down to the, you know, this big slide, which to me at the time was, I was just reacting. It was just something I did. And that slide made my phone start ringing like mad. Yeah. And so many things have happened because of that. That bass gave me a sound, which, you know, it's hard for a bass player to have a sound, you know, because so many basses sound very much alike, and we're supposed to sit in the background and not do anything to attract too much attention. And so it was all just intuitive choices that I was making that led to a real payoff of having an identity as a player, and hopefully being known as a guy that played the song.
Yeah.
And so the Keith stuff was real important to me, and it was followed pretty quickly by a couple years later by Trisha Yearwood. And then things just started happening, you know, and Emmylou Lou called me to play on one of her records, and you know, she had heard that bass, and she
and they told said, two friends, you know, and so on.
Bring the, you know, bring the bass from, yeah, she called it the bass from space. And what a thrill, you know, to get to do that. And I played that instrument on Alan Jackson's first three singles, on the first record, Here in the Real World and Neon Rainbow and Wanted, all three of those songs. And so really fortunate to get to make this very gradual transition into studio work. And eventually it led me to get off the road with Don Williams at the end of 93. But I stayed with Don for 14 years, and it was an incredible journey and a very hard to leave, but it was just time, time for me to be in town. I'd gotten a divorce and my kids were teenagers and I needed to spend more time with them. And so I was able to make that transition, thankfully, over a long period of time before I cut the cord of working with Don, and really very blessed to have gotten to play on some really fun projects with a lot of people, and also get to do my own stuff on the side, you know, with bands like Three Ring Circle and the Jamie Hartford Band and the bass orchestra from time to time, and then making my own records too. But I really owe so much of it all to Don Williams and his encouragement of me, for sure.
Sounds like it. Sounds like it. That's very cool. If you could give guitar lessons to your younger self, what would be the first thing you'd want to kind of hone in?
Well, I presume you mean bass lessons.
I'm sorry. Yes, you are correct. Ha! Edit. Yeah. If you were to give bass lessons, in fact, I'm looking right at it. Yeah. I can't even believe I just said,
That's
good.
That's
if you could give bass lessons to your younger self, what would be it?
I think I would just say learn to listen a little bit more. You know, don't throw me off when I'm singing.
That Don Williams approach is so
key. That is what I, because it's not saying you can't be creative. It's just that being aware of your surroundings. And I always kind of gravitated in my own stuff to smaller groups, 3 and 4 piece bands, partially, I guess, because it gave the bass a little more of an active role. But I think I would just say to my younger self, just, you know, don't be afraid to, like, just listen to what everybody else is doing and breathe once in a while.
Yeah.
Rather than fill in every single space, because it's tempting.
So, in your opinion, who would you put at the top of your list of favorite bass players?
That's always a tough question, but I'd say in terms of the person that gave me the most inspiration to really pursue it, Jack Bruce from Cream.
Oh, yes.
I think still very underappreciated. Jack passed away a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the Beatles, it was like an oil painting. I couldn't dissect it. Mm-hmm. You just heard that as those records are so great, you just heard them as one thing. Mm-hmm. And I never really thought, even though I was aware that Paul McCartney was playing a bass, I never really separated it out from everything else. But when Cream came along in 1966, you know, right around the time I was switching over to electric, you know, there were three guys, one guy playing guitar and singing a little bit, one guy looking really crazy and playing the drums, and then this guy writing the songs, singing lead, and playing the heck out of the bass. And that was Jack Bruce. Mm-hmm. And Sunshine of Your Love was the first riff that I ever learned when I discovered what a riff was.
Right.
Because I had only understood about chords and notes and not really patterns. And so when I learned, figured out how to play that by ear, that was kind of the beginning of that. And Jack, all through his career, was an inspiration to me. I think very underappreciated. Because, you know, Eric Clapton was the big deal in that band, and that's great. But Jack went on to make some incredibly innovative music, and so he was really inspiring to me. Eberhard Weber also as a composer. I also loved John Entwistle from The Who, and I loved Chris Squire from Yes. But and the other person I would put in that top five would be Roy Husky Jr., who was a wonderful bass player here in Nashville. His dad was a famous bass player who played string bass on, you know, like a lot of the early country stuff, played on the Grand Ole Opry. Roy's dad, Roy Sr., died when Roy was 14, and Roy picked up the bass and began to play, and he was just a genius of the instrument, and he was the most humble, you know, sweet guy. You know, he grew up in Madison, you know, and very, I mean, as country as it gets. And but yet he was a phenomenal musician. He was probably best known for his time in Emmy Lou's Nash Ramblers band. When she kind of went sort of acoustic. But he played on a lot of records. He played on records with the O'Kanes. And Roy had this way, he underplayed, and he would, he could hear things like whatever space he was in, whether it was a club or a concert hall or a booth in a recording studio, his ears were so big that he could hear the resonant, he could hear what notes were jumping out and what notes were soft, and he would adjust his playing on the bass on the fly to play that note that's not speaking. He would play that note a little bit harder, and the note that's too loud, he would play that note a little bit softer, all in the middle of performing a part. And it was just amazing. And he was in the bass orchestra a couple of times and really enjoyed it. And I've got a great phone message from him. But Roy, unfortunately, passed away just like his dad at the age of 40.
Wow.
In 1997, it was really unfortunate, a little bit self-inflicted. He was smoked little cigars, and he was inhaling them, and nobody knew he was inhaling them, and he eventually died of lung cancer. But I feel Roy's presence now, 20 years later. I feel him all the time. He's anytime I play string bass, he's like it's literally standing on my shoulder going, "That's a good note. Hang on to it for a minute." And it's great. So Roy is very special to me. I mean, and he was the guy who made the string bass hip again, like with the O'Kanes and some of those records in the 90s when nobody wanted to fool with string bass. And so I always have to put Roy on that list.
What kind of challenges does a person have who, say, they start with a player that migrates between the upright and the electric? What are there, like, big challenges?
Well, I mean, I thought a lot of it is just physical because, you know, you're dealing in the difference, you know, between, like, a short-scale electric bass can be as short as 29-inch fingerboard. Standard is 34, but a string bass is anywhere from, you know, 40 to 42.
Okay.
And so just physically, the stretches are different. But there's also a mental attitude of when your hands are in that upright position, you're carrying on this tradition that goes all the way back to, you know, the Jimmy Blanton and you know, Ray Brown and Charles Mingus and these incredible players. And I have to say, Mingus is definitely on my list, too.
Yeah.
I mean, just as a hero, a musical hero of every kind.
Absolutely.
I just absolutely adore his music. But I think, you know, physically being and also understanding sonically when to do one or the other, I think is part of it as well. But I think the challenge is mostly physical. And if you're like me and you're not the most organized fingering guy, because I know guys that they do everything the same way and they move up the neck and it's all very symmetrical and beautiful, and my fingering is very kind of self-taught and not terribly organized, but I seem to always be able to get to what I'm trying to do.
Right.
But I think, you know, it's one of those things, if you're a real organized player, there are things you would definitely need to do to learn different fingerings, because like with string bass, it's mostly 1, 2, and 4, and you don't use your third finger a lot, whereas in string bass, I mean, electric bass, it's kind of anything goes. So it's a challenge, and I think a lot of it too is just kind of knowing what's, you know, what fits where, and there's always a new curve. You know, you can always find something new in the instrument. So to me, it's a never-ending journey. I'm still figuring that out.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, on the humanitarian side of things, I neglected to mention at the top of the broadcast that you have been the president of the Nashville Musicians Association, AFM Local 257.
The longest name ever.
I'm telling you, I wish I could say I memorized that, but I had to read
it.
It's a handful. But when did you become such an advocate for working musicians? First of all, may I just say thank you as a person who is trying to be a working musician.
Well, thank you. You're welcome. It's been a very interesting journey. It's nothing I ever would have thought possible or even likely or even... You know, it just was not on my radar at all. Very early on after joining the union, I saw the benefit. The first year I was with Don, we played a gig at Giant Stadium in the fall of 1980. And my life was complete. I just played Giant Stadium. Are you kidding?
I'm
getting paid,
yeah.
too. This is amazing. Unbeknownst to me, the show was being filmed. And about a month or so later, in December of 1980, I get a call. Hey, man, you're on TV. I'm like, what? They say, yeah, Channel 4, Casey Kasem's America's Top 40. And I turn on the TV, and sure enough, there we are at Giant Stadium playing Don's current single, which was Good Old Boys Like Me, which was number one record in the country. And I think, God, I'm on TV. That's cool. And then a couple weeks later, a check for like $1,000 shows up. And I'm like,
Robin.
God, that's really nice.
All right, then. I'll take that.
And then in January, they aired the song again because it was still number one, and I got another check. And then I found out that through SAG-AFTRA, I was getting 2 years of health insurance for me and my family from those two checks because at that time, the threshold was $1,000. It's much higher now.
Right.
And I was like, wow, this union stuff's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I, you know, didn't think about a whole lot and just, you know, kept doing stuff around town. In the early 90s, I was playing a lot at a place called Douglas Corner, we all know.
Yes.
And I started getting hassled by one of the business agents at the union for doing this gig without a contract. And I would go in, I'd say, look, you got to understand, this is my band, my music. We're hiring the club for the price of a sound person and a door person, and it's up to me to get people in the club, and that's how we get paid.
Yeah, and it helps you too.
And there is no contract.
Right.
And so, you know, I looked at the guy, and I said, well, what do you want me to do? Forge a contract? And he looked at me, and he kind of nodded his head, and I went, oh, man. So I did that. I did that for about 6 months, and then we had a meeting, and I think it was the fall of 91. We had a meeting, and I stood up at the meeting at the end. You know, it was kind of open, you know, discussion. I said, you know, I want to talk about playing for the door and why I have to lie about it.
Right.
And I don't feel good about that. I got two kids I'm trying to teach to tell the truth. Why should I have to do that? And the president turned to the guy who'd been hassling me and said, what do you know about this? And he said, oh, first time I ever heard of it.
Oh!
So they made me head of a committee, and we got together a couple of times, and we wrote a bylaw that said, very simply, when playing original music in a listening room, the band leader, me, can be the employer. And it fixed that problem. We could file contracts, pay the work dues, but I didn't have to lie and forge somebody else's signature.
Right.
So that happened. And then as I got more and more into studio work in the 2000s, you know, in the late 90s and 2000s, there became this disconnect within the union where the national leader had kind of figured out, he was a DC guy, and he had figured out that if you keep everybody fighting, you can't be... You know, they can't vote you out of office if everybody's fighting with one another. They're too busy doing that to get organized to find another thing. It's an age-old political tactic still going on.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, our local leaders had kind of lost perspective, and they kind of signed on to his agenda. And to put it nicely, I think they just kind of forgot who was working for who.
Okay.
They were supposed to be working for us, and they kind of got a little complacent about it and just, well, you know, we're just, you know, want to be kept in the manner in which we're accustomed to. And so I started asking more questions. A lot of people did. The disharmony started in LA because those people were getting hurt the worst because basically the union wasn't taking care of its bottom line. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, we need some money. Well, we need $1 million. Well, let's just tax the recording musicians on the back end, and there's not enough of them to stop us, so we'll just do that. And so they did. And it started a lot of discontent.
Yeah.
And so
how long did they get away with that?
A couple of years.
Okay.
And then we fixed it in 2005. I went to the first AF convention that I'd been to, and we kind of fixed it. And I, at that point, had become president of a sort of subgroup of the Nashville Union called the Recording Musicians Association, which each local, you know, of the union can have that. It's basically a subgroup representing the people who record. Mm-hmm. And there's also like a theater musicians mm-hmm. group and mm-hmm. different mm-hmm. things. And so I had become president of the Nashville chapter, which was kind of had withered on the vine. And we had about 20 people. And it was in the early days of email. Mm-hmm. And so I was all over that. And so I built it up to about 200 of the best recording musicians in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we had a voice. Mm-hmm. And so we got to communicating with New York and LA recording musicians and started really questioning the status quo. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another. And in 2007, we went to the convention, and they basically ran us over with a steamroller and put the tax back on. And it was really bad. It was a bad situation. And so on a local level, you know, I kept trying to work within the system. I was a member of the executive board. I'd been on the hearing board before that because I believe in the structure. I believed in the institution. Mm-hmm. And it just got to a certain point where it was like, you know, the only way this is going to change is if we get rid of our leaders and give our generation a chance to screw it up on our own.
Exactly.
And so complicated by the fact that the elected officers were also national board members. They'd also been elected to a national office, and so we ran a campaign, a very proactive, you know, a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails. You know, we ran a very proactive campaign, and much to everyone's surprise, we won. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time in the 120-year history of the AFM that sitting national officers had been voted out in their home local.
Wow.
So it was a big deal.
That's massive.
And it started a revolution.
Yeah.
In New York, 6 months later, same thing happened, where a working Broadway musician, trumpet player, ran against the establishment and won. And then all of a sudden, we got New York and LA and Nashville on the same page for the first time ever.
Yeah.
And so we were able to go to the next convention and identify the board member who we felt was the one person who could defeat the incumbent president, and we approached him. His name was Ray Hare from Dallas, Texas, and he agreed, and we put together what we called the unity ticket, mm-hmm. and we ran at the convention, and we voted out the president, vice president, 4 to 5 board members.
Wow.
And so now I've been a national officer of the AFM since 2010.
Okay.
And here in locally, I've been reelected now 3 times.
Right.
To 3-year terms without opposition.
I was just going to say.
Mainly because nobody wants my job.
No, I don't know if anybody can put up with the stuff like you. I think you're
well,
I think
and it's
you're,
just
you're
something that I just got passionate about it because, you know, one, the organization had been good to me, but also I would seem to always be that guy in the band that would speak up when other people were nervous about speaking up.
Right.
I remember very early in my time with Don Williams, I went to him and I said, Don, this is the best gig I've ever had in my life, but I'm still having a little bit of trouble making ends meet. If there's any way I could get just a tiny raise, it would really help me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sure enough, in the next paycheck, everybody got a raise.
Oh, bless you.
Hey, man, we got a raise. That's
you
cool.
are a man of influence.
And it's just like, and I can't say it was completely unselfish because I was just asking for me. I wasn't asking on behalf of the whole band because
that speaks well for Don too.
Yeah, exactly.
For his level of
exactly.
Fairness.
And
that's
as soon
really
as
cool.
he was like, oh, okay, you know, because I don't know why anybody else hadn't said anything, but I just seem to become that guy sometimes, and as you can tell, and the listeners can too, I like to talk, so it's been a very interesting thing, and it's been, you know, for me, a real mission of modernizing and unthugging the union, all those stereotypes. I mean, I am still apologizing for things that my predecessors did to people where they were just, no, they didn't threaten them with a gun or break their legs, but they just treated them badly.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that's like, why would you want to do it? And Tennessee is a right-to-work state, so
yeah.
no one has to be in the union.
Right.
And so you have to me, it's a no-brainer. People yeah. have to want to be in the union and go, why wouldn't I want to be part of that?
Yeah.
So for me, it's kind of all part of the same thing, you know, mm-hmm. and I love Nashville. My dreams have all come true here. And if I can make that happen for some younger guys. And that was one of the big problems was that there was about a 15-year period where anybody young with questions really didn't get the time of day.
Right.
And we've changed that completely. And I do a lot of work for the guys that play down on Broadway. A lot of them are not members mm-hmm. because what I figured out about 3 years into the gig is that I represent all of the musicians of Nashville, mm-hmm. not just the members, because the other people don't have anybody.
Right.
And the city, the mayor, the police, the taxi commissioner, they're only going to listen to me.
Right.
So I'm trying to listen to everybody, and, you know, we're trying to keep the taxi cabs from destroying musicians' ability to get in and out of the clubs downtown. They disobey the law.
Yeah.
I have to call the police and ask for meetings. I report them to the taxi commission. I mean, it's just like, I just want people to do the right thing.
Understood.
Nashville's the last place where this still happens, where you can't just get away with being a total jerk.
Yeah.
You can to some degree.
Right.
But really, you know, it's all about doing the right thing. And so when I see people who come to Nashville from LA or wherever else, yeah, and they got lots of money and a huge company, mm-hmm, that makes very successful products, mm-hmm, that need music, mm-hmm, and they won't do it through the union.
Hmm.
Why? Because they say, oh, the back-end residuals on video games are so prohibitive, we can't possibly do it through the union. There are no back-end residuals on video games.
I didn't think there were.
And,
I was
and they use
that sounds new.
They use that as an excuse, uh-huh, to pay people scab wages, like pay people like what you would an independent artist who's making a limited pressing record would,
wow,
pay. And no benefits, no pension, and even worse, no protection for their intellectual property.
Yeah.
You know, we get people pay for stuff that goes way back. Mazda just paid the musicians who played on a Patsy Cline record in 1962 10 times what they made. And those six people who are still alive got that, and the six people who've passed away, their beneficiaries got that money. Because that's what intellectual property is, even before there was a name for it.
Right.
It was here in Nashville when Owen Bradley and Chet Atkins said, if you're, mm-hmm, going to use our guys, you're going to do it right.
Yeah.
And so when big companies like Electronic Arts come to Nashville, take advantage of people, and then try to paint themselves as heroes, I have a problem with that. And I'll talk about it publicly. I'm doing it right now.
There
I don't like it.
But it's part of
it. But it's the thing is, it would be so easy for them to do the right thing. And they would get a better product.
Yeah.
Because now they're filling some of those orchestra chairs with students.
Yeah.
And people, because some people will say no.
Yeah.
Other people who should say no don't.
Yeah.
We all got to eat.
Yeah.
I don't ever want to punish musicians for taking work.
Yeah.
But when you're talking huge billion-dollar corporations who can afford to do the right thing, I'm not going to stop trying to get them to do the right thing.
There you go.
But then I can play the bass and I get my mind back. So,
there you go. Right.
That's my therapy.
Go grab the beast.
Yeah. And I'm still getting to play and you know, as much as I can and make records and do stuff, because I never want to stop being creative.
Right.
Because the only times that I've ever gotten discouraged or down about why did I take this job? What am I doing? What am I thinking? It's like you're not playing the bass, man.
Right.
Play the bass.
Yeah.
I can literally just go play the bass for 30 minutes and feel better about a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah, go back to basics. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So what's next for you? I mean, it sounds like you've got enough going on right now.
That's a great question.
Golly gee, I really hate to put more on your plate, but what you got going?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm working on a new record with a really fun band called the Chemo Sabis.
Love it.
My friends Ricky Ray Rector and Rick Lano. Drums and guitar, and we've been in the studio and writing together and doing a little producing here and there when I can. And, you know, I think about the timeline. I'm 61, mm-hmm, about to be 62 in a couple weeks. If I get elected two more times, I'll be 67.
Mm-hmm.
And at 65, my pension's going to kick in, and Social Security and that stuff will kick in soon after. And so I'll be maybe in a position at 65 to start paying off some of my bills and try to simplify my life. And I don't want to hand it off until there's somebody really great to hand it off to.
Go.
And we have identified, you know, some young musicians who are getting involved, mm-hmm, and doing stuff. But, you know, if I were to give the members 3 years notice at the age of 67 – and say, I'm going to do one more term, and then I'm going to quit at 70. And then at 70, I, you know, get my electric car that I'll have by then, no doubt, and throw all my gear in it and drive around the country doing solo gigs.
There you go.
Or whatever. Yeah. I honestly, I mean, I'm very fulfilled, mm-hmm, in my professional life, and I don't really see a need to, like, it's sort of like, you know, retire. It's, mm-hmm, like the guy,
yeah,
you know, they tell that joke about the guy at the circus that sweeps up behind the elephants, you know, and he's like 89 years old. And they go, don't you want to retire? And he says, what, and quit show business? You know, it's similar to that. I love what I do. I love getting people paid. It's really exciting when you can work out a situation that was headed for bad vibes and lawsuits and all kinds of stuff. And you can figure out a way to get people to meet in the middle. Honestly, a whole lot of what I do as a union guy is a whole lot like being a bass player. You got people on either side and you're trying to bring them to the middle.
That's good.
Negotiations are that. So much of the conversations I have tend to be that same thing. So I guess it's just God's way of keeping the bass player part of me alive even when I'm not playing the bass.
Isn't that something? That is a great analogy.
It took me a while to figure that out, but it's really true.
I've got two more questions.
Okay.
The first question is, how can people get in touch with you if they want to know more about unions or if they just want to know more about you?
Absolutely. I have a pretty extensive website, even though, of course, websites are very obsolete now.
Are you on the Twitter, people. Son?
I'm on the Twitter.
Are you on the Facebooks?
I'm on the Instagram and the Twitter and the, and all that good stuff, you know. I'm still, you know, figuring it out. But I've had a website for a long time. I've put out 12 CDs and 2 DVDs over the years. We have the Sleepy Le Beef movie and then the Day the Bass Players Took Over the World.
I really want to see that.
We re-released that from the 90s with some new footage. And my son's a filmmaker, so he's collaborated with me on those, my son Seth. And then there's all kinds of records, a bunch of different stuff. There's samples of everything. So if they want to know about me, the musician, DavePomeroy.com.
Okay.
The union stuff is at NashvilleMusicians.org because we are a nonprofit.
Okay.
And, and you actually just Google Nashville Musicians. It'll come up. And there's a lot of stuff on our website about how you can, you know, what we do, how you join. I try to keep the balance there. And what we tried to do with the union is just really open it up and make it understand that it's not some elite thing that's only for the symphony or it's only for session people. Mm-hmm. It can be for everybody. And, you know, I've gone downtown and so far I'm 7-for-7 in the courtroom defending musicians who got a ticket for trying to work around the taxi cabs who are actually the ones violating the law. So I'm 7-for-7 in court. I got another one coming up. You know, I think that my brother and sister are lawyers. I got a little bit of that.
Yeah.
One time the judge did make me sit down. He said, son, if you're not a member of the bar, you need to sit down.
Like, okay.
But I coach the guys on what they need to say and just to be respectful and just go, look, I couldn't do what I needed to do legally and I have a job and I'm trying to get in. So, you know, there's always something. There's always a new wrinkle. But, you know, a Facebook, of course, is a big deal these days. And, I'm not quite to my friend limit. So anybody who's interested, I've got a Dave Pomeroy Facebook page and also a Dave Pomeroy Earwave Music. Okay. My label is called Earwave. And so if you go to earwavemusic.com, it takes you directly to the DavePomeroy.com store.
Okay.
So if you just want to get in there and spend some money, buy some stuff, come there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love having that stuff out there. And it's interesting. Sleepy Le Beef has fans all over the world. I mailed out a DVD to Hong Kong the other day.
Love it.
And it's like, you know, so one person from France, one person from here. So
that's so cool.
I love that we can make the world smaller in that way. And that's one of my mottos is that music makes the world smaller in so many ways. These connections that come about, there's no other way that would have happened. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it over and over again. And it used to surprise me. And now I just go, no, music makes the world smaller. And definitely makes the world a better place.
It really does. It really does. Well, my final question before we head into the fun part of the interview is actually inspired by my buddy, Mr. Babbitt. He told me a long time ago, I remember this, I was sitting in his driveway, summer of 2005. Kid, you got to do what you got to do to satisfy your soul. That's what he told me. So what is it about the bass guitar that satisfies your soul?
I think it's just being able to make people feel something, you know, just the delivery of emotion, I think is really what it is. I mean, you know, there's a show-off factor to it. When I play solo, I'm really trying to do things that should probably not even be attempted, but I'm doing it as a sense of fulfillment. And as a bass player, you know, you can influence the direction of the music in very subtle ways. It's kind of like you're directing people in a play and they don't even know that they're necessarily being directed.
Yeah.
But it's not a control thing as much as it is like a facilitating, let's all feel that groove.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you see an audience of people dancing, you know, with Sleepy Le Beef, he would put these medleys together and like literally you'd see people would dance for 45 minutes without stopping because he wouldn't stop.
Oh, gosh.
And then they like stagger off thinking, those people are going to wake up tomorrow sore, remembering that they were at a Sleepy Little Beefcake.
Right.
So I think a lot of it has to do with that. That just, you know, it's just the delivery of emotion. I think that's the best way I could say it. It's just, I got something I want to say. It doesn't necessarily involve words this time. Mm-hmm. It might, but mm-hmm. if it doesn't, I'm just trying to express an emotion. You know, I love writing instrumentals. I love titling instrumentals because you can imply things, mm-hmm. and it means different things to different people, and it's okay.
Okay. Know? That's awesome. That is. This has been so great. There's so much more I want to ask you, but we'll respect your time. But now we have what I like to call our little audio Rorschach test. This okay. is called Take Your Pick. Get it? Pick. You're a bass player.
Yes. Yeah,
I know sometimes. I know you do. Okay, it's just it's this or this. Not a whole lot of thought required. Okay. All right, ready? Okay. Here we go. Beatles or Stones?
Beatles.
Zeppelin or The Who?
The Who.
Bass strings, round or flat?
I'm in the middle. I'm a pressure round, which is half round.
Okay. Coke or Pepsi?
Neither.
Peanut butter, smooth or chunky?
Chunky.
My man. Chocolate or vanilla?
Chocolate.
There you go. That's what I'm saying. Okay, live or studio?
Ooh.
That's always a tough
tie.
One. This, yeah, I was gonna. Yes is also considered an answer. Okay. An acceptable answer.
Yes,
toilet
time.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Toilet paper, over or under?
Over.
Toothpaste from the middle of the tube or squeeze it from the bottom?
Middle. Should be the bottom.
Amps, Acoustic 360 or the Ampegs?
Ampeg.
Okay. Victor Wooten or Stanley Clarke?
Ooh. Yes.
Here's another one for you. Bob Babbitt or Carole Kaye?
Yes. But I met Carol once or twice, but it's hard for me to pick on that one. But yeah. Carol, they're both incredible and very similar. Almost got to throw Joe Osborne in there, and make it even more complicated.
There you go. 4 a.m. Get up or go to bed.
Go to bed.
And finally, baseline Superstition or What's Going On. Just remember,
I would say What's Going On only because Superstition is kind of a clavinet line.
True. You're right. You are right. Ding! Man, I knew I couldn't put anything past you. I knew it. But all I could think is I remember seeing that video of Marvin sitting at the keys, at the piano, and Jamerson's just right behind him with that mm-hmm. one finger. Just yeah. more funk in that one finger than some bass players will ever have in their whole career. Just that one finger. So,
yep.
Well, sweetheart, Dave, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Thank you, Marcia, and thank you, NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
Dedicated to bringing you inspiration, education, and behind-the-scenes stories from prominent guitarists and others influential in the music profession. To hear more, subscribe to the Nashville Guitar Store podcast in iTunes. Go to NashvilleGuitarStore.com or find us on Facebook and Instagram.